grateful that you are willing to share with us your ideas on the philosophy of culture, of course, which he's teaching right now. So, welcome, Mark.
Yep. Thanks for coming, everybody, especially... I feel a little guilty giving this talk on a beautiful day. Okay, that was all I needed. That's great, yeah. But thank you for coming. I hope it will be enjoyable and interesting. Let's see, that's the projector fan, is that right? I guess we can turn it. Or is that... we can turn it.
Yeah.
I guess we don't need that. I just thought I'd show that YouTube video because I only recently came across it. And a student, Jenny, you knew about it. You'd seen it. How do we turn this on? Again. There we go. Good. So I have... Come on, Inchichin. So I have a few remarks to make, and then I hope we'll have a little discussion. Thanks to Pat for putting me up to doing this. I think I tried to get out of it a couple times. Gabriella, thank you for organizing it. Appreciate it very much. So what I want to talk about today is what we might mean by philosophy of culture. And I'm going to give you a little context for that. But first I need to say that philosophers have a really bad history with this question. In a couple of ways. I mean, first of all, philosophers... I have a bad habit of starting talks by saying negative things about philosophers. Philosophers have traditionally thought of themselves as not subject to culture. As kind of outside of time, in a way. Which is a crazy idea. And when we tell the history of philosophy in courses, because we have our own history of philosophy sequence, because we don't trust the history people to tell our history, because it's a very special history. We tell it as if philosophy were happening outside of everybody else's history. It's the strangest thing. I really have never understood it. So I'm not sure if philosophers are really very well qualified to talk about culture. So that's kind of the first point I needed to make. The second thing I needed to say was that... there are very few texts in the history of philosophy that address the nature of culture. Some of you know this fellow Ernst Cassirer. He was a neo-Kantian, and he wrote a very interesting set of books called The Philosophy of Symbolic Forms. Very few people read them today, and really, you can't blame them. They're really not very relevant to anything. But I was fascinated by them at one point. Let me give you a little bit of personal background now that the fan is off. My first recent interest in this topic came from my first collaboration with Gabriella, when we did a course some years ago on magic and mysticism in the Renaissance. And at that time, one of the questions I was preoccupied by was the transition, how the transition occurred in Europe from a largely superstitious and magical way of thinking about the world to a somewhat more scientific way of thinking about the world. One of the results of the collaboration was that I learned that we didn't completely make that transition, of course. And so... So that's a complicated history, and one of the things I depend on in a kind of parasitical way is working with people that are much more knowledgeable and smarter than myself. And so I learned a tremendous amount from Gabriella, and I owe her a tremendous debt for that. My interest in culture took a long break while I did two things. I was working on a course on happiness, and I was working on a course on wisdom. And you may know that Gonzaga, of course, has a fairly heavy teaching load. We teach a fair number of students and a fair number of classes, and so it's not uncommon, many of you do this, I'm sure, to work in our research interests with our teaching. So my interest in philosophy of culture, happiness, wisdom, they all get worked out in courses, as many of us do. And so I had these other interests, and I needed to wait for my kids to graduate from high school so that I could kind of focus on other things. And then also, during that time, I was working on... I did some part-time administration for Gonzaga, helping the school develop more programs in different places besides Florence. And that was really interesting work. It was dangerous administrative work because Gonzaga was not used to thinking about study abroad outside of Florence. And it was dangerous for a number of reasons, but it was also very rewarding. It took me to a lot of places, and it involved working with a lot of faculty. And during a period of about 5 years, 7 years, Gonzaga expanded tremendously its study abroad offerings. And my last engagement with that I finally moved on from somewhat reluctantly, was supervising Fulbright scholars who have been coming to Gonzaga for 6 years now to teach Arabic. So Gonzaga started offering Arabic language classes, which was again a kind of a change for us. So I made a full recovery from administrative work, and I came back to being a faculty member. And I wanted to become more involved in some of the programs that I had helped other faculty create. And so some of you know that in addition to my abiding interest in coming to Florence, I've become involved in a program in Africa that goes to Benin. And so the Benin program, the combination of the possibility of thinking about philosophy of culture through U.S. culture, through Italian culture, and through African culture created a kind of constellation that I've built a research program on. And this term, I'm offering philosophy of culture for the first time, having taken several years to develop readings in it. So that's kind of the background. Now, I will go to Benin again this summer, and I'm working with Tarun Holland, who some of you know. We just had approval to team teach philosophy of culture that would be cross-listed in Italian studies. So my course this term has about one-third content, Italian-related content, and when we team teach this next spring on campus, we'll have about two-thirds Italian content. The Benin course, needless to say, has very little Italian content. But it has a lot of African content. And so the questions are a little different, of course, very different in different places. I hope someday to teach it in the U.S. with U.S. content. I've developed some resources there, but for the moment, that's kind of the research agenda. Now, the research goal, which is also, of course, the teaching goal, since these things have to happen kind of together, is to understand the nature of culture with a view to being able to engage in a critical discourse about culture, which goes beyond descriptive understanding and appreciation. And this goal, especially the part about a critical discourse, that is the ability to ask and answer critical questions about a culture, should really make you a bit nervous. Because the history in anthropology, in philosophy, in politics, the history of criticizing cultures has not been a very good one. In fact, we refer to the 19th century efforts in anthropology as racist anthropology. And to do this. Because when we start to develop a critical view of the nature of culture, we often wind up committing terrible intellectual sins. And so we're just about 8 minutes underway, and I've already given you two good reasons to think that I'm incompetent to do what I've said I will set out to do, and that even if I were to accomplish it, it would likely go terribly wrong. So I'm sorry about that. I'm just going to do my best. And I'm not the first person to want to do this. Of course, critical questions about culture are raised across a number of disciplines. If philosophers have anything interesting to offer, it's the interdisciplinarity, and it's the attempt to ask slightly different kinds of questions than get asked within a discipline which is committed to a method or set of methods. So philosophers are, in some sense, I'll just leave it there. So, we're interlopers. We're often interlopers in other people's business. And we have to kind of be comfortable with that. And so I don't want to give the impression that I'm the first person to ask these kinds of questions. I'm certainly not. I do think philosophy is at a very interesting moment. I think the disciplines that have been studying culture are at a very interesting moment for interdisciplinary work. So I will say on my behalf, one thing maybe, which is that this is a very, given recent research across a number of disciplines, this is a very interesting moment to try to reach out and connect the dots. Okay? So I have three things I want to do. I want to tell you a little bit about, I want to say a little bit about typical ways that we study culture and some of their limitations. And I'll have to be very careful not to give offense, because I don't think there's anything wrong with studying culture in these traditional ways. I think that's very important, actually. But I do think that typical ways that we study culture leave a number of questions completely unanswered. And so, as a philosopher, I want to address some of those questions. Then I want to tell you a little bit about how I've been approaching culture as I decided finally, after many years, that it was good to give myself a label, because I was kind of tired of other people giving me a label for what I was. And so I'm approaching this as what might be called a postmodern naturalist. And so I'll say a little bit about what a postmodern naturalist might, how I'm approaching culture as a postmodern naturalist. And then I want to say a little bit about a critical philosophy of culture. What would it mean to actually accomplish the goal? And we're in this is the early stage, you know, of only a few years into the research and first course offering, so this is very preliminary. I'll try to be brief. I'll pick on Neanderthals for my comments in the critical phase, because they're not here, and so we can talk about them. Okay. So, typical ways to approach culture usually involve a couple of different goals. One is that we tend to approach culture by learning it. So we teach courses on the Renaissance here. Many of you teach courses on the Renaissance. And so we teach people to learn the names of the painters, the paintings, the methods they used. We teach them to connect the paintings to the politics and the social history, right? And this is a wonderful thing to engage in. Please don't misunderstand me. I think this is really an important thing to do. And you can't do what I'm going to try to do unless you actually study culture this way. The concern, I guess, I have is that let's call this studying culture to understand identity. It might be the identity of your own identity, or it might be the identity of people in the Renaissance. And this is both to study, to construct our identity by reflection on somebody else's, or to get in touch with our own through some history, some historical analysis. We could study the history of the settlement of North America as a way of understanding the identity of Americans, for example. And that's not a bad thing. I want to be very clear about that. We also study culture this way because we want to make identifications with others. We want to make connections. My concern is that this ignores the fact that we also use cultures to conceal our identity. We also use cultures to conceal problems, to differentiate ourselves from others. We use culture to claim superiority over others. And so when we study culture as a form of identity making, we kind of set those other questions aside. That in fact culture is used to ambiguate identity and to conceal identity and to separate ourselves, not just to identify with others. So celebrating culture, immersing ourselves in culture, is a wonderful thing. Study abroad is one of the ways we do that. We acquire skills and competencies from that, and those are very important. But learning about cultures is not the same as learning what culture is. That's my point, right? So, another thing we do in traditional ways of studying culture is we entertain what I'd like to call for today the great cultures hypothesis. And that's a hypothesis that many of us operate with, that when we scan history and we scan geography of human experience, we can identify great cultures, peaks. And intuitively, there's absolutely nothing wrong with saying that, right? Clearly, Greek democracy, Greek philosophy was a peak in many ways in cultural development. The Renaissance was a high point in many ways for art and so many things, right? Banking, for example. The Enlightenment was a peak moment in the history of culture. The immersion of the idea of international rights. You know, so I'm not saying that those are illusions, but again, look at what gets left out. If you entertain the great cultures hypothesis, you never study the valleys. You never ask, how does culture operate when it's not producing great moments? Because culture is operating all the time. Culture is operating here at Gonzaga in Florence, within this building, in very interesting and complex ways. Right? So studying the peaks is not going to get you to the nature of culture. But it's still an incredibly valuable thing, and I don't want to say anything negative about it, except it can't do everything, of course. And so what it leaves out, as a philosopher, I'm interested in what gets left out. And since I'm trying to understand culture completely, I don't want to leave anything out. Okay, so those are two examples of typical ways that we study culture, and maybe some things that aren't, not so much wrong with doing that. They're wonderful things to do, to learn cultures. But the key point would be that learning about cultures and learning, trying to figure out what culture is, are really two different things. Does that make sense? Okay. Great. Okay, so let's say a little bit about what it means to move forward. If those are kind of obstacles to making progress in understanding culture. Please come in. Oh, hi. Oh, did you bring? Oh, how exciting. Oh, we have to take a moment here. Yes.
I'm sorry.
No, please. This is great. No, this is fantastic. I'm so glad you came. And introduce, please, introduce.
This is Clint and Dina.
Yes, everybody has to see. I hope I keep her asleep. Is that okay? Oh, no, that's fine, please. I hope I don't wake. Okay, that's one. Now, see, Charles is here. Okay, so, now I'm worried maybe I should speak this over here. Okay, so, how do we make progress? Well, the first thing we need to do is to understand that culture has a history. And I don't mean specific cultures. Of course, the Renaissance has a history. Greek philosophy has a history. I mean culture itself has a history. We didn't always do this. We weren't always human. We weren't always Homo sapiens. We weren't always producing culture. Right? So we need to appreciate not so much the history of the Renaissance, but we need to tell a story, and we do this in the course, and by the way, as I go through this, I'll mention some things that we actually read in the course and talk about. And we do some physical anthropology, right? So we know a lot more in the last couple of decades than we used to about the story of how our species came to produce culture, and it's an incredible story. And while I'm not an expert in archaeology and physical anthropology, as I told you, philosophers are great interlopers. We just wander into other people's disciplines at will, like a bad house guest wandering into the rooms that they're not supposed to go into. And so studying culture, studying the history of culture itself is a way to make progress. Because we spend so much time thinking that when you study culture, you should study the history of a particular culture. But in fact, the question to start getting your head around is, when did we start doing this? Meaning culture. And the short answer is when we became the kinds of people that we are, right? When our brains went from 300 cubic centimeters to 1,500 cubic centimeters. Right? When our, actually making childbirth kind of difficult sometimes. 1,300 cubic centimeters. 15 sounded a little too big. We're on our way. So it's important to study that culture has a history. It's also important to do this because it keeps us from thinking that culture comes from some other place besides nature. For most of our time as humans thinking about culture, we've thought of culture as non-natural. We've thought of culture as something that came to us from the gods. And I'm not ruling out any hypotheses here. The fact that there's a natural history, which we understand better than ever, about how our species came to produce culture, in no way rules out the possibility of a divine creator. It just means that this is how it worked, and we'd better study it, or we won't understand it. Right? So when we do that, we find out that culture is something we started to engage in because we started to live in groups, because we made campsites, because we controlled fire, because our brains got bigger, because we became capable of something called social cognition, which I'll say a little bit more about in a minute. Something you all know. And as soon as I remind you of it, you'll say, oh yeah, I understand what that is. We developed agriculture. A key part of having culture is having agriculture. Because agriculture allowed us to build towns and cities, to differentiate roles, and to do lots of things that show up on this thing called the Human Relations Action File, which I was going to read to you from. It's a list of dozens of things that we do in culture. Age grading, sports, bodily adornment, calendars, cleanliness training, community organization, cooking, cooperative labor, cosmology, courtship, dancing, decorative art, divination, division of labor, dream interpretation, education. Okay, you get the idea. So I want you, for this talk, I want you to think of culture less in terms of cultural artifacts like the paintings and sculptures of the Renaissance, and more in terms of social behaviors and capabilities, things we can do because we're the species that we are. And when we study the natural history of culture itself, we also learn that we're not the only species that engages in culture. We do it in some incredibly distinctive ways, some ways that no other species, as far as we know, does. But, and this is a result that's only been arrived at in my lifetime. When I was a child, people routinely said, oh, only humans have culture. Simply not true. Right? We can talk about examples of non-human cultural behaviors. One of the reasons we didn't understand non-human culture in social species that engage in culture, for instance, would you guess that ants engage in agriculture? Oh my God, this is something I only learned in the last few years. Yes, they engage in agriculture. Fascinating. They're good at it, too. I mean, they don't produce tomatoes like we like to eat here, but they do engage in agriculture. So even in my lifetime, we've broadened, well, especially in the last 20 years, we've developed new thoughts about the nature of human culture, and we've understood that to engage in culture is not a uniquely human thing, though humans may do it in a uniquely human way. And this again helps pierce the illusion that culture comes to us from outside of nature, which is one of the most dangerous illusions I think we could have. That culture somehow comes to us from a place outside of nature. We engage in culture, as far as we know, because of our natural history. And there is no fundamental opposition, in my opinion, between nature and culture, though there are useful reasons for distinguishing nature from culture. Culture comes from nature. There's no other place that we know that it could have come from. And again, as I said, that does not exclude the hypothesis of a divine creator at all. It's a wholly separate matter. Okay, so to appreciate this story in the course, so far she's staying asleep. We read archaeology, physical and cultural anthropology. We surveyed some great and not so great moments in the history of anthropology. We read Clifford Geertz's Thick Description, which some of you may have read in your university studies, very important essay still. It comes at the beginning of symbolic anthropology or semiotic anthropology. We had a student presentation on epigenetics, which was absolutely extraordinary. It's on the wiki page, by the way. If you want to access materials in the course, you just go to alfino.org, click on the wiki, and you go to the course wiki, and you'll find a variety of very interesting resources, some of which were student projects. Two biology majors did a talk on epigenetics that I recommend all of you listen to. It's just fantastic. We also read about fashion. We read an ethnography about the Palio in Siena that was fascinating. And so we are connecting things large and small, although the Palio is not small. It's smaller than the emergence of these human brains that engage in culture. Okay, so I just wanted to pick one thing in particular that I thought might be interesting to you before we go on to the last part of the talk. And I'm mostly focusing on what it means to be a naturalist. I'll say a little bit about what it means to be a postmodern. That's very hard to do in a short period of time. So, but anyway, while we're still on the naturalism, the question that I think I find myself drawn to a lot in my research is, what is it about our cognitive architecture that allows us to engage in culture? What is it about the ways that we can think? Since we got these big brains, what is it about the ways that we can think that allows us to engage in culture? And the old answer used to be language. And that's still not a bad answer. But it's turning out more and more, and this is very recent research from primatologists and linguistic anthropologists, it turns out a better answer might be language comes from the ability to engage in social cognition. So let me say a little bit about social cognition just to give you an idea of what that is. Social cognition is this remarkable ability that you'll recognize as soon as I tell you about it. It's captured somewhat in recursive grammatical construction, so I'll just say this one. The fact that you can understand the sentence I'm about to say is an example of social cognition. I know that you know that I know what you mean. Right? Here we go. I know that you know that I know what you mean. And a textbook example is, let's say we're planning a surprise birthday party for Jacinta. Do you like surprise birthday parties?
Very much.
Okay. So we're planning a surprise birthday party for her for Friday. Let's say that's her birthday. And Pat and I are planning it. And Giatina comes in and she says, oh, guess what? I'm going to Trieste on Friday. Now, Pat and I don't even have to look at each other. And we know what each other is thinking, right? That's social cognition, right? It's amazing. It's not just language. We can engage in social cognition apart from any communication. Then, if we start to look at each other, we... You know, I have one other example to give you, if you don't mind. We just started late, so please don't hold the time against me so much. I was on the bus the other day coming back from this place that I swim, and there was this Italian woman standing in the well of the bus, the exit, you know, door, and she had one of the things on her cell phone so she could talk into her cell phone, and she was talking very loudly, but she was also being very clear. She was enunciating very clearly, which, of course, you know, speakers don't always do, right? And I was sitting with a group of, with one guy and then a group of four seats in front, and I noticed a woman, and I had my earphones in listening to my music, and I noticed a woman in that group of four women who had a bag on her lap that had EF, and EF is a language institute. It happens to be the one that my son went to in Paris as well. And so there's an EF here. There's probably several EF facilities here. And so that meant that this group of women were probably studying Italian in Florence. So that's an inference without talking to them, right? So this woman's talking loudly on her cell phone, and by the way, she is the whole conversation. The other person on the other end isn't saying anything. She has a lot to say to this person. She's enunciating clearly, and it's, you know how it is when you're learning a language. It's Italian that I was getting a relatively higher percentage of than some other Italian. So the language learning, the women in the group, they were starting to listen to her, and I pulled out my earphone because I was wondering, and at first I was like, oh, I don't want to hear this. This is too, I won't understand it. And I pulled out my earphone and I start listening, and I'm like, oh, okay, I think I can probably get some of this. This might be fun. And then I look at them, and again, it's just like the surprise birthday party. By the end of the bus ride, I could have written two or three paragraphs of things that I knew, that they knew, that I knew about this situation, right? That's social cognition. It's an amazing thing that we do. And some of the more recent theories about the nature of culture put a lot of stock in the power of social cognition. Because this is a dangerous statement to make. The comparison group is often apes, because apes do pretty darn well. Apes. Sometimes I think they do better than us. Apes can recognize themselves in a mirror. Monkeys can. Humans usually can. Sometimes they're shocked. Oh, no. Okay, so that's social cognition. Now, that helps us answer the question of what it is that allows us to engage in culture. Okay, that's an example, and we study that in the course in so many ways. The postmodern aspect I won't say much about. It's just too hard to do in a short period of time, but here's my effort. Culture should be understood naturalistically, but it's not determined by its natural history. And that's an important point, because if you just say you're a naturalist about culture, people will think you're a determinist. And I'm not a determinist. And the reason I'm not a determinist is because culture is inherently unpredictable. You just cannot predict what's going to happen. Who would have predicted the Arab Spring? Who would have predicted the Renaissance following the plague? You know, culture is, the term we use in the literature and in the course is, culture is in some peculiar way sui generis. And this is one of the things that has kept us from understanding it. Because it's so unpredictable, it seems like it's not connected to nature. The hard thing to think about, which has been occupying me a lot lately, is to bear in mind that it is wholly natural, and yet it is sui generis. And postmodern theory has resources, in my opinion, for thinking about that paradox. And that's about all I'll say. In the Ethnography of the Palio, the woman who wrote it, Crocini, uses Gilles Deleuze, who some of you may know is a French theorist, postmodern theorist. And she uses it to good effect. It winds up being pretty hard for the students, but that would be an example of in the course of where we use postmodern thought. Okay, let me wrap up then. The third thing I promised I would do is say a little bit about critical philosophy of culture. So what is my hope to arrive at in terms of studying all this? What do I hope to be able to do? Remember, I told you, I hope to be able to criticize cultures. And I told you should be nervous about that ambition, because previous efforts to do that have often produced horrible theories, racist theories, right? So why am I trying to do that? Well, let's pick on Neanderthals for a little while, because they're gone. We may have eaten them. Did you know that? They're recently discovered Neanderthals. You've read across this. Yeah, read it. This is where you learn this kind of stuff. We found some Neanderthal bones that looked like they'd been to the Machalaria, you know. they'd been carved. That's one possibility. Now, the other possibility is that we intermarried a little bit. And I want to go on record as saying I don't think I've ever had sex with a Neanderthal. But some of my ancestors may have, right? And so we may have intermarried with them. We may have some Neanderthal in our ancestry. Or we may have eaten them. Or both. But what is it about Neanderthals that's interesting? Well, a lot, actually. It turns out they had language. Cognitive anthropology and cognitive archaeology are relatively new disciplines that people engage in to determine what the cognitive capacities of species that are extinct and species that we only have archaeological evidence of were. And because of, well, I won't go into it. Anyway, so we know that Neanderthals had language. We know that they didn't bury their dead with artifacts, which means that they did not think of their dead as going anywhere. But humans did. Homo sapiens did. And that's an important cognitive difference. We also know that Neanderthals didn't develop their spear technology very well. And that meant that we skewered them, probably. Our spears and our ability to combine spear points with spears, lengths, you know. And Neanderthals had bigger brains than we did. It's not like they lacked fundamental cognitive capacity in that sense. Okay, so you can get insights from these new disciplines which attempt to figure out just where the paths diverged. Because we were a sister species, we could have interbred with them. And there's at least some evidence that we did. Okay. So, I've been giving you historical examples because I think they're interesting. But I want to be very clear that in the context of the course, we do a lot of contemporary study. In fact, as I told you, a third of the course is Italian cultural content. So let me just say a couple of things that come up in the course that are related to developing a capacity to criticize a culture. Now remember, this is a dangerous thing to do, right? If you criticize your culture as an insider, you're either engaging in politics or you're a traitor, right? Nothing wrong with engaging in politics. I think we should go this way. You're in a different party. You think we should go that way, right? But you could develop a criticism that puts you at odds with your culture, as Socrates did, and then they kill him, right? He's a traitor. If you engage in criticism of a culture as an outsider, the best thing we could say about you is that you're very rude. Right? So criticizing cultures is dangerous whether you're doing it from inside or outside. And I'm very self-conscious about engaging in raising critical questions about Italian culture as a repeat visitor to Florence. Nonetheless, the project seems to require it. And this time, the timing helped out because we had a very interesting election this semester. And we had a very interesting movie that came out, Girlfriend in a Coma, which helped create critical resources around raising questions about the nature of Italian culture. In the course, we studied some history of Italian unification, right? So we did some historical study. We studied Gramsci, who is one of the most brilliant Italian philosophers ever, and whose concept of hegemony is becoming even more relevant today in ways that we can't get into right now. So we studied the question of whether Italy actually did unify or not. Very interesting question. Whether it should unify. Should Italians keep trying to unify? Or should they go a different direction? Because after all, just because it seemed like a good idea in the Risorgimento doesn't mean it was. And now with globalization, is unification around nationhood really what we should be trying to do? So these are kinds of critical questions that come up when you have a cultural period that you can study, like the period from the Risorgimento to today in Italian culture. And we studied Gramsci because Gramsci, as you know, was a critic of his own culture, a very profound critic of his own culture. And his criticisms are extraordinarily relevant today. And they help, actually, with criticisms of U.S. culture. So I wanted to suggest also that we engage in the course in criticisms of U.S. culture, because studying something like the Palio, for example, tells us something about what U.S. culture doesn't have. We don't have, the students were very impressed by this, we don't have festivals like the Palio, partly because we don't have 800 years of history of responding to the kinds of things that the Sienese responded to over such a long period of time. So it's not a fault that U.S. culture doesn't have it, but it means that we can raise critical questions about what's not present in U.S. culture. When it comes to U.S. culture, there are plenty of things to criticize. Our energy consumption, our hegemonic culture, our projection of military power, our role in climate change. So there's no shortage of things to criticize. And if we can develop tools about how we came to engage in culture, we may find insights about why it is that there are certain kinds of cultural transitions we're not good at. Like the transition to a new way of consuming energy, or the transition from Italy to the European Union, or the transition from, well, take war. War is one of the constants of human cultural experience. The idea that a culture like the U.S. considers itself a very peace-loving culture, but it projects the most military power of any human civilization to date, with no end in sight. Maybe there shouldn't be. And then when we get to Benin, we have tremendous issues. We have to appreciate why Benin is such an incredibly peaceful and friendly culture with incredible cultural resources. And yet we all want to know why Benin doesn't develop to feed its people. We want to know why some cultures have trouble developing their ability to feed their own people.
Okay, I'm almost done.
So, the image I want to leave you with is the following. I'm fully aware that criticizing cultures is a dangerous thing to engage in, and it's a potentially offensive thing to engage in. But the danger of not criticizing is also quite great. And the image I'll give you, it's a textbook image, right? Some of you know about Easter Island, right? Easter Island is a South Pacific island off the coast of Chile. It's a very isolated place. Humans have only lived there since about the 700s. And it's become a textbook example of the dangers of cultural blindness. Because you know what happened on Easter Island? Over a period of about 100 years, from the 1600s to the 1700s, a disaster happened there. Their population declined from 15,000 to 2,000 or less. And the reason it did is because they deforested the island. And one reason they deforested the island, there are several, but one of the main reasons they deforested the island was because they were committed to building these huge stone sculptures called Moe. I was going to give you some images of Moe. You can pull them up on your own time. They're interesting. But it takes a lot of wood to get these sculptures up in the air, you know, to get them upright. And so they deforested their entire island. You have to wonder what they were thinking as they cut the last tree down. And then they started eating each other. And I'm sorry, cannibalism is a recurring theme in this talk. But we're almost done. And so the point is this, right? Easter Island is cited as a parable of the danger of blindness to cultural criticism. Because we could be on a path like that. Oh boy, we're just about there. Give her the binky. Yeah. Okay. So, with apologies, I'll end there. I want to suggest then that there's an interdisciplinary task, a research program that hopefully will play out over the next few years in a number of different places, Benin, the U.S., and hopefully Torin and I are probably going to apply to come back here to teach the course for Italian studies. And that it involves a very interdisciplinary project involving many new disciplines and research that's fairly new, and some many old things, and that it involves cultural criticism, which has its dangers, but also has the potential to keep us from making huge cultural mistakes. And so I think it's an important thing for us to be thinking about. And I thank you for the time that you've given to listening. Okay.